It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC, FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We are New York and New Jersey Public Radio, and now the FCC won't take away our license. With us now, our own Bob Garfield, co-host of On the Media, who has a new book that asserts that the rise of identity politics and the collapse of the media advertising market are intersecting in a uniquely toxic way that is a threat to democracy and this country's basic idea of itself. That's a big thought right there, and there is more that goes into it. So let's talk to Bob Garfield, whose book is called American Manifesto, Saving Democracy from Villains, Vandals, and Ourselves. Hi, Bob. Welcome to the weekday side of WNYC.
Thank you, Brian.
Let's start with the media angle, since that's what you're best known for in public radio land. You write that the collapse of the media economy has neutered media's ability to watchdog the powerful and to inform the public. And I think you and I take this for granted as fact because we work in journalism and we see what's going on around us. But for everyone else, can you describe the nature of the collapse of the media economy and the extent to which you think it's collapsed?
Yeah, so the digital revolution gave us Easy Pass and TikTok, you know, and Minecraft, so that's good. And it destroyed the media economy, and that's bad. And there are two ways that it is having an effect on the body politic. But the first is that news organizations can't run at a profit. I mean, there are a handful in the world of news organizations robust enough to cover the news vigorously and rigorously. Thank goodness public radio is in that very small group of healthy media organizations, but what used to be the world's most profitable business for 300 years is in desperate straits, and that's why your local newspapers are skinnier than they ever were. That's why the bureaus are closed. That's why they're not covering the state house or the county courthouse. That's why government is not being watchdogged at any level except the highest level of national politics. The watchdogs are starving to death.
Why wouldn't 21st century advertising pay the bills once the technology catches up, like 20th century advertising did? Like, there are actually more people consuming more pages of news media content because of the web and social media than ever before. I think you'd agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
So why couldn't digital advertising replace the old models? Like, ads follow us around now from website to website. You know, that pair of shoes I once looked at on Amazon shows up in front of me wherever online I go.
Yeah, hold that thought about the shoes, because it figures into something else in a moment. But, well, there's three reasons. The first is there used to be 100,000 news organizations of any scale in the world. And they were divvying up about, you know, $600 billion of the overall global advertising spend. Now there are tens or hundreds of millions of media entities, you know, whether blogs or podcasts or CBS or Facebook, and tens or hundreds of millions of them, and they're fighting over the same $600 million. So that obviously means that every individual news organization is getting a smaller slice of the pie. But it's a little worse than that, because when there's so much supply, and so that obviously has the opposite effect on demand, and therefore brands, advertisers, can afford to pay less to reach the same number of people. It's a supply and demand thing that is immutable. So it's been ruinous to the revenue side of news organizations.
So into this void come Facebook and Google, who you advocate should both be broken up. And you cite a stat that together they have sucked up 25% of the revenue out of the global advertising economy. How does that happen, since they're not producing 25% of the content?
Because they're aggregating everybody else's, and they're selling the ads against it, and they're throwing some pennies at the originators of the content. But they have, through their enormous data trove, figured out the most efficient way to distribute and the most efficient way to target. And advertisers, you know, certainly get the best bang for the buck going there. So from the advertiser's point of view, they're working out pretty well. But from the point of view of the people who create the content, it's a parasite and a ruinous one.
And so to cut to the chase, with what effect on your bottom line concerns, which are not really how media organizations make money, but it's about democracy and it's about our sense of ourselves as a nation.
Yeah. So let me go back to the pair of shoes, if I may. If you buy, you know, if you shop for a pair of shoes and you don't buy, or if you do, the ad that you looked at or the content you looked at follows you around the internet, right? Well, that's called retargeting in the advertising side of the digital universe. But that's how Facebook and YouTube and other gigantic digital platforms work in their content too. They make money by keeping you on their sites, right? Facebook doesn't care what you look at per se. They just want you to be on Facebook. So they will serve you what you have showed an interest in seeing before. And they will serve even more of it if you have shared it. Now, if Amber Neese sends you pictures of her wall-eyed dog and you don't even open it, the Amber Neese's stuff is going to stop coming onto your newsfeed. But if you click on professional soccer, or if you click on Nazis or conspiracy theories or Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders, you're going to get more and more of that. And this is what has created what they call filter bubbles. And we get more and more of what we've shown we are interested in and less and less of the rest of the world. And this has the effect of putting us in these impermeable bubbles where we're not just tribes, political tribes, but nano tribes reside. And they are impervious. These bubbles are impervious to facts and truth and reality from the outside world, because you just keep getting more and more of what you feel has validated you or given you a charge of emotion like rage to begin with. And so they treat their users almost like addicts. Their business model is the same as the Sinaloa cartel. And they don't care whether it's good for you or not. They just want to keep you on their pages. And sadly, it works.
So that reinforces tribalism. It reinforces rage, you point out, as opposed to reasoned debate. So how would breaking up Facebook and Google address that?
I think in a number of ways. My notion is to separate the advertising part of the business from the platform part of the business, which is not an easy trick. But they are organized wholly to keep faces on their pages. And if the content and utility part of the business were separated from the advertising side of the business, they would have the content side of the business would have less incentive to be not only amoral about what happens to its users, but in my view, immoral, because they know the harm they're causing. And in any event, they have too much money and they have too much power. They have impunity. Mark Zuckerberg periodically goes and makes big promises of how he's been chastened and things are going to change. And, oh, we didn't do as well as we would have liked to. But Mark Zuckerberg is a liar, and has made those claims, for the entire history of Facebook. And the situation keeps getting worse and worse. And democracy suffers in ways that are staggering. The public is so disaffected by our political circumstances, so distrustful of institutions, that 30% of those age 30 and under are willing to consider other forms of government, including authoritarianism and army rule. Army rule!
I saw that stat. 18%, was it something like that, said they would consider army rule a plus for this country?
There are so many data sets that got me in a lather to write this book. But it's on the left and on the right, the distrust is horrifying. And, you know, the United States is a 243-year-old exercise, an experiment in democracy. And the errors and the failures and the sins go all the way back, and they are horrifying. And as we know, we are in a political situation now of utter ideological gridlock and, I say, a burgeoning tyranny, a depraved executive a branch of government, and things are bad, but, you know, we still have political freedom, and we're way better off than other societies, you know, let's say Russia and China and Venezuela and Nicaragua and Myanmar and Brazil and Turkey. So let's not throw out the democracy baby with the political frustration bathwater.
If you're just joining us, maybe you're hearing that voice and thinking, wait, did I sleep all the way through till Sunday morning? But it is Bob Garfield, co-host of WNYC's On the Media, who has a new book called American Manifesto, Saving Democracy from Villains, Vandals, and Ourselves. So that's the media piece, or some of it. Now let's go even deeper. You question the Central American idea that we have a right to expect upward mobility or the pursuit of happiness, as the Declaration of Independence put it, as a formula. You say that that expectation is a formula for a sense of failure and shame on a grand scale. And with shame comes grievance, and with grievance comes conflict. Those are big thoughts and big leaps, but I saw you've said it pretty much just like that. You want to connect those dots?
Sure. You know, Thomas Jefferson said we were guaranteed the pursuit of happiness, and this kind of morphed into the notion of the American dream and the upward mobility, and people are drawn to us not only for our political freedom, but for the ability to do, this is the only society in the world that explicitly promises you that whatever your station in life is, you come here and you can improve on that. And it is drummed into us from the time we are very, very small. This is America. Everyone can be president of the United States, which, you know, has some truth to it, and it's a great notion. And it is one of the reasons we are a beacon to the world. Political freedom is obviously another one, economic opportunity. But this is not my dad was a shepherd and his dad was a shepherd and his dad was a shepherd, so I guess I'll be a shepherd too sort of society.
I thought this is a good thing, this upward mobility.
Well, it is a good thing until the point when it isn't. And the point when it isn't is when it leads to the inevitable disappointment for those who believe not only have they disappointed everybody by not becoming president or becoming rich or becoming big mockers in their communities, they've disappointed themselves. We are a nation increasingly of Willy Lomans who feel like they just haven't measured up. They didn't do what their commencement speakers told them to do, and they didn't do what Jefferson told them to do. They did not improve their lot.
And Willie Loman, the character from the old Arthur Miller play, Death of a Salesman, who never really makes it, and he becomes mired in sort of grievance and self-loathing.
Exactly. And what you've just described, of course, is Trumpism.
Well, you're very critical of Trump and Trumpism and how he enables white supremacists and everything. But you also seem critical in this regard of many marginalized groups asking to be treated equally. You refer to, quote, ever finer subcategories of grievance, and with that, micro tribes of political identity, unquote. So why raise that issue in that way?
For a couple reasons. One is that it has to do with one of the core premises of the book, which is that the convergence of identity as a peculiarly and the peculiarly American version of that pursuit, and the fragmenting of the media. So fragmented media times fragmented identity yields chaos. That's one of the premises of the book. So that's one thing I have to say. The second thing is this book is by me. It's my analysis as a citizen. It is not the On the Media book. It is not the WNYC book.
Right.
And I know I'm treading into some very tender areas here, but I was talking about the nation that has 243 years of history, much of it horrendous. I mean, for crying out loud, slavery. and Tuskegee and the Trail of Tears and Abu Ghraib and the Vietnam War and the overthrow of governments in Chile and Iran, you name it. We have a lot to answer for as a society. And we also have to answer for systematic oppression of marginalized groups, powerless groups that remained powerless. And one of the glories of identity politics is that since the Second World War, it has been the power behind slow, incremental, but very, very significant changes in the society that restored some or all political rights and economic opportunities and so forth to hitherto marginalized, even oppressed groups, which is great. That's the way it's supposed to work. However, what has happened in the last 30 years is that the subgroups and the grievances that go with them get ever finer, finer and finer and finer. And now even within, for example, the feminists, there are 23 subgroups of feminists, some very tribal, some and a lot of internecine warfare among them. If you go into the LGBT community, the same thing. These same larger groups that have won political freedom and justice over decades are now so fragmenting that they're working against one another. It's a kind of factionalism and internecine warfare. And by the way, come ever more granular groups of grievance. And one of the consequences of that is it has created a backlash from the right. Because from the perspective of the right, all of these incremental groups' achievements toward a liberal democracy have been a series of slaps in the face to their traditional values, their culture, the America they remember. And this has created an equal and opposite set of grievances. Perhaps not just, not reasonable, but very, very real. And that, too, is Trumpism.
But is this too easy for you to sit back and judge as a straight white male? So if, like, women were much more discriminated...
I'm sorry, an attractive and charming straight white male.
I left out that subgroup of your identity.
Of course.
Those two subgroups. But, you know, if women as a group were more discriminated in the past than they are today, and there have been some advances on equal rights for women, but now that's starting to change at the macro level, black women can say, well, you know, feminism as it's been run and dominated by white women hasn't represented me fully. That's a bad thing. I mean, there's more room because of the progress for groups that have been marginalized further down the chain, if you want to look at it that way, to speak up, and it doesn't make their issues illegitimate.
This is a very good question, and I think you anticipate my answer, which is that I'm not judging the merits of anyone's grievance. I believe in social justice to the nth degree. What I am talking about is the effect. I know I think I can be agnostic or even support of ever finer interest groups and identity groups and grievances, but I also have to acknowledge that one of the consequences to it is backlash. That's one of them,
yes.
The backlash on the right, which has created the alt-right and Trumpism.
Right.
The other backlash is the lack of coalition. I mean, if you were trying to create a social movement to counter the larger social movement on the right, if you were on the left right now in any one of these nano identity groups, you render yourself powerless because your coalition doesn't behave as one. Because everybody is fighting amongst themselves, it reduces the ability of the larger population on the left to have an impact. And Twitter battles do not change societies.
We're going to take a break and then take some phone calls. My guest is on the media's Bob Garfield, who's got a new book that, as he says, is not the On the Media Manifesto, it's his, called American Manifesto, Saving Democracy from Villains, Vandals, and Ourselves, about the intersection of increasing micro-identity politics and the collapse of the media economy to threaten democracy and our sense of ourselves as a nation. And we can take a few phone calls for people who've already seen the book or have been listening to Bob here. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. But before we go to the break and then take those calls, tie it all up for us. How dystopian is your vision of the future, and how quickly, if the current media economy collapse and identity fragmentation continue on their current trajectories?
I believe the current trajectory is doom. Now, luckily, we are also on a trajectory of doom for the entire planet. So everything I'm writing about is going to be rendered moot because the Earth is a cinder at the moment.
But me laughing at the doom of the entire planet.
That said, I wish I could offer optimism. I think the American Manifesto and the 6-point platform I proposed to do something about it, which by the way presumes that that we're not going to restore equilibrium and justice through the government. The judiciary is going to be unchanging for a generation, and there's no reason to think that the Senate is going to change hands to the Democrats. I'm not a Democrat, but I don't think the Democrats are going to get a hold of the Senate anytime soon with a supermajority that's going to change laws. So I think it behooves citizens to take action in a certain set of ways, which is in the aggregate a kind of Hail Mary pass against a state of affairs which is headed towards calamity.
And to one of your points there, today also happens to be the 10th anniversary of the Citizens United court ruling. And you say that dark money has put the GOP in power far disproportionately to public desires. So we'll leave that as self-explanatory. And we'll continue in a minute with Bob Garfield and your calls and the points from his manifesto for saving American democracy. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with On the Media co-host Bob Garfield, who's got a new book called American Manifesto, Saving Democracy from Villains, Vandals, and Ourselves. And Sophia in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Sophia.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
Big fan. I just wanted to touch on an earlier point that you guys were talking about in terms of social media and the way in which that's kind of creating a tribalism or a separation of interest groups. I guess my question is, at what point does that move into a space of propaganda and indoctrination? Because as is the case of populations of people in different states around the world, people who are using Facebook or these different platforms, this is all they see and all they know. But in their case, they don't even know that they're not seeing what they don't see and don't know. So it's causing this incredible separation, which, as Bob was saying, you could argue is leading to Bolsonaro and to Trump and to Brexit. So it's something that's very, very serious. So what are the actual strategies that you can have to try and piece that apart and that system of information control?
That's why you framed your book as a manifesto, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, the reason one of my manifesto planks is to call for the breakup of the Facebook-Google duopoly is through one means or another, Facebook has to change its algorithm and its business model that leads not only to the proliferation of conspiracy theories here about Comet Pizza and the Democratic Party running a pedophile ring in the basement of some retail shops on Wisconsin Avenue in Washington, but
which was an actual conspiracy theory for people who don't know that led a guy ultimately to go in there and fire a gun.
Yeah, he had a AR-15 and he popped off a few rounds to protect the children on insane, bonkers conspiracy theory that lived and thrived in these bubbles of social media. Our 2016 election was disrupted by Russians and domestic scoundrels and bots who who used social media to propound similar crazy ideas, lies, and so forth. The stakes have been much higher elsewhere. In Myanmar, incited pogroms. And what was at the core of that is that Facebook distributed, it gave people free digital access, what do you call it on your phone when you have access to?
Yeah, everything was free on the web, and we thought we had a right to that. Information wants to be free. We thought that was the value statement.
Yeah, well, of course, that was a misunderstanding of the notion of information wants to be free. It wasn't meant to mean free of charge. But in this case, Facebook gave away web minutes or phone minutes free of charge, and the Myanmarians, Burmese, used it and were fed a series of ethnic incitements that caused Buddhists to kill Muslim minorities. So it was the apotheosis of online dystopia, and the stakes are very, very, very high. So, you know, one of the first things I would do is shame or legislate or litigate Facebook into having to dismantle the algorithm that causes this.
I'm just going to read out loud the six planks of your manifesto so people can hear them all together. In brief, number one is pay for media. That's what we were just talking about, so that there is a media economy to replace the advertising economy, so news can actually be reported. Number two is break up the Google and Facebook duopoly. Number three is boycott partisan media, such as Fox News. We're going to come back to that one. Number four is educate yourself and others how to identify non-credible news. Number five is find ways to encourage national dialogue across ideologies. And number six is focus on a we're all in this together message. So on the item of boycotting partisan news, and you cite Fox explicitly, what about partisan or ideological news on the other side? The Nation, MSNBC, whatever? Or do you see those as false equivalencies?
Oh, absolutely false equivalency. And I don't, you know, I'm not telling people to boycott partisan news organizations. What I am entertaining is the idea of people boycotting advertisers who sustained organizations that purport to be news or media, but in fact are just propaganda arms of the far right, and that's what Fox News is. It's what it has been for 20 years, and it is to compare it to MSNBC or even more strident left wing organizations like The Nation or Mother Jones. Is exactly false equivalency, because there's actually a challenge issued in the chapter of the manifesto, which is an exercise where you find things that are false. First, you have to locate things that are actually false on the news on the left, you know, or the mainstream. Then you have to show that it has not been corrected. And then you have to show that there was some sort of intent, that there was no documentary or evidentiary or rigor behind the reporting. And what you're going to do is you're going to come up with a big blank. You may find some inflected news because The Nation views things through a progressive lens. What you're going to find on Fox News is lies, propaganda, spin, apologia for an out of control, depraved administration. It is Trump state TV.
One more call. Francisco in Bloomfield. You're on WNYC with Bob Garfield. Hi, Francisco.
Hi. How are you, Brian? Hi. How are you, Bob? I wanted to make a statement pretty much, you know, and since you mentioned Fox, Roger Ailes was pretty much a genius when he went out there. And I'm going with the whole thing that was on online about putting information out there that was basically going to look like it was true, and it was, you know, appealing to the right. And you know, that genie, you know, was out of the bottle since he started doing this. And it's going to be pretty difficult to try to put that genie back in, because if you know, our kids need to be educated about what these things are without trying to make it partisan at the grammar school level, grade school level, to start understanding the thing that they're most impressionable by, that thing that they hold in their hands. They don't have to sit on a couch and watch on a 42-inch TV. They could watch on a 6-inch right. screen that they walk around all over the place. So that's what we need to start educating. And you're absolutely right. It's going to probably be a generation before the citizens of this country realize that, you know, it has to go back to basics, and a government has to be responsible for that.
Francisco, I'm gonna leave it there. We're almost out of time in the segment. So after everything that he just said, do you notice that he ended with government has to be responsible for that? But I'm sure you don't want to tell, well, I'm not sure, but I would guess that you don't want the government to tell Fox News what it can and cannot
Absolutely
broadcast.
Absolutely.
So what is the role of the government, in your opinion?
Well, for the purposes of this manifesto, I don't think we can look to the government and to our current institutions, the three branches of government, to come to the rescue. I think we as citizens have to put pressure on various branches of government to do what they have taken an oath to preserve, and that's the Constitution. But a lot of this has to do with what we can do ourselves as citizens. As this caller was talking about, to educate ourselves, to become literate about the media that we consume, know how to evaluate it. Also to vote with our dollars when it comes to the advertisers who support divisive partisan propaganda organizations. There's a lot we can put pressure to shame antitrust measures on the duopoly, to force them to make changes internally for fear of being legislated or litigated into breakup. There's things we can do and must do to preserve a society that is has a history of enormous failures and is still the greatest idea for the organization of citizens ever conceived on Earth.
Bob Garfield, co-host of WNYC's On the Media, now the author of American Manifesto, Saving Democracy from Villains, Vandals, and Ourselves. He will have an event at 6 o'clock tonight, if you want to see him in person, at the Grand Central Branch of the New York Public Library with the media writer Ken Oletta. So Ken Oletta gets the next crack at interviewing Bob Garfield about his book tonight at 6 o'clock at the New York Public Library Grand Central Branch. Bob, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.